I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Let me go ahead and start off with a couple of disclaimers. If you know who I am and you've been around or I've been around you, there may be some earlier speaker tapes out there in my story, and there may be a few discrepancies. When I first got to tell my story early in my sobriety, I still believed a lot of the stories I had still been telling. So I think some of you might be able to relate to that. The other one is that I understand Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand the traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to work with some what I consider giants that brought me up as a baby in this program and taught me about the steps and the books and the traditions and service and the whole nine yards. And I know that one of the things my sponsor taught me was that if I showed up somewhere to speak, that I need to show up looking like a speaker. So he showed me what a speaker looked like because I never knew. The other thing is I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it was like and what happened is all my stuff. And what it's like now, the people in these rooms gave me because I came totally bankrupt. So there is a few outside issues in my story. The other thing I want to do is make sure that I stay politically correct. So what I found out was things have changed through some of the years that I've been sober and probably will continue. One of the things is when I first started figuring stuff out, I found out that I grew up in an alcoholic home. Then when I went to treatment, I found out it wasn't an alcoholic home. It was a dysfunctional family. And now we're into the 2000s and everybody's being politically correct, so I need to make sure everybody's on the same page with this. We're no longer dysfunctional families. We're now clinically interesting families. Okay? So now we're all caught up. And when I say I grew up in an alcoholic home, my father was an alcoholic, in my opinion. And he's still a practicing alcoholic to this day. I didn't realize my dad was an alcoholic when I was growing up. I just thought that was the way of life. And my parents divorced when I was 3 years old. And my mother took my older sister and my younger brother, and my dad took me. And I never saw or heard from them again. So my dad raised me. So I got to grow up with a good alcoholic. And I grew up in the bars, and I grew up doing the things that alcoholics do. I remember I was so small, first of all, in the bars, that they still had the wooden Coke crates. And they used to stack one on its end so I could see over the pool table to play pool. I would get out of daycare or from the babysitter, Dad would pick me up and we would go to the bar. And I would meet my new future weekend mom, 6 months mom, till dawn do us part mom, all of those moms. And so that's how I grew up. I grew up in the bars, and I grew up on the pool tables, and I grew up on the pinball machines, and I would drink Cokes and eat Fritos, and Dad would play pool and drink and chase women. And that's how my life started. When I was 6 years old, we were in a bar. And my dad was playing pool with a man. And he came over and he sat down at the table with us in the booth, and he told me that he had just bet this man that I could drink a water glass full of whiskey without making a face. And he bet him $20. And if I would do it, I could have the $20. So they called the barmaid over. She set a glass in front of me. They poured it full of whiskey. I drank it down and asked for my $20. That's the last thing I remember. I woke up the next morning basically with my dad waking me up. I was laying in a cot because we lived in a shack. My dad was one of those alcoholics that it was chicken today, feathers tomorrow. And he was patting me on the back, and I was covered in puke, and he was telling me I'd now became a man. So then when we would go to the bars, Dad would always order two and slide me one. My dad was the type of alcoholic that was an abusive alcoholic. And I remember lots of days that I didn't go to school because my eyes were swelled shut. I remember lots of days that I woke up on the floor and didn't know what I did, but knew I didn't want to do it again. And my dad was also the type of alcoholic that took geographical cures. So if something hit the fan, we were somewhere else by morning. He would pick me up from school and everything's packed in the truck and we would go somewhere else. I would get home from school, everything's packed in the truck and we'd go somewhere else. And he started teaching me from a young age that if you had anything you couldn't throw in the back of your truck and take off with, you didn't need it. He also taught me that any time that we were in the bar and he ended up in a fight and if things went bad, you go to the car and you get my gun. And that's how I grew up. So things rocked along, and to give you an idea a little bit about the geographical cures, from the time I was in first grade to third grade, I went to 12 different schools. And I would get to one school, I didn't know what they were talking about, and I'd get to another school, and I learned that stuff last year. And that's how it went. Then I got a little bit older, and he got a little bit wilder. So then I got to spend 6 months with this aunt, 6 months with that aunt, 6 months with this grandma, 6 months with this uncle, 6 months here, 6 months there. And I can remember before I started junior high school, I used to lay in bed at night in someone else's house and cry. I wondered why my mom never wanted me, why my brother and sister were better than me, and why my dad didn't want me anymore. So I went on and followed in my dad's footsteps. And I started drinking more and more and more. By the time I hit seventh grade, I was introduced to those funny cigarettes. And I'd always been told, alcohol and drinking is okay. People who do drugs are sorry, bad people. And so I didn't want any part of it. But the more it was offered, the more I thought about it, the more I thought I'd better try it. And so I did one day at school at lunchtime. And I decided from that point on, I would be better than my dad. And my career took off. By the time I hit ninth grade in high school, I had tried just about anything they had out there at that time for me to try. I lived in the state of Washington at that time, and we would go at lunchtime and pick mushrooms. And we would then go back to school and be teacher's aide in the girls' PE class. On through my high school career, I did some sports. I never did real good in school. If I just barely passed, that was good enough for my dad. He didn't expect anything but no failing. And so I did just good enough to get by. And I went on to do some sports. I went on to do some wrestling. I went on to do some football, some track, and things like that. And so during school, I would have my Letterman's jacket on, and at lunchtime and after school, I would be in the alleys. And that's how it went. I would go to the keg parties, and that was just the way life was. I blacked out every time I drank from the time I was 6 years old up until I quit drinking. Every time I drank, I was a blackout drinker. And every time I drank, the next day you would get those phone calls or your buddies would show up and ask you if you remember what you did last night. And it wasn't cool to let them know you didn't remember what you did last night. So every time they would tell you something you did, you'd have to laugh and say, yeah, wasn't that great? And that's how I grew up. And that was my life. I graduated from high school and barely did that because one night my dad came home and decided it was my turn to go to the hospital. And that night when the cops came and found me, they suggested I not go home anymore. And so I went to school the next day and told the principal I was checking out of school because I no longer had a place to live and I had to find a job and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know what he thought, but it kind of freaked him out some. So he said, wait, and he got with the school counselor and assistant principal and In about 20 minutes, they came back in that room I was in, and they said, "We'll make you a deal. If you don't quit school, we'll give you a job here at the school as a janitor, and you can work nights." And the first thing that went through my head was, they're going to pay me to go to school. Okay. A buddy let me, his mom let me start living in their camping trailer, and I went on and I finished and I graduated high school. My dad and me had got back together a little bit here and there through that, and I would see him uptown coming out of one of the bars or whatever, and he would give me $20 and things like that, or buy a bottle and we'd sit down and talk. And about that time, he got moved to a job in Adak Island, Alaska, to go put in the freshwater tanks for the Navy. And I got in his pickup, and I went to Ruidoso Downs, New Mexico, and went to work at the racetrack with the racehorses as a groom. I grew up in the country and around horses all my life. And I told that man at that racetrack, the first one I met, and asked for a job. He asked if I knew anything about racehorses, and I said no. But I've been around horses all my life, and I know horses. He said, that's good enough. So I went to work at the racetrack. And I was cleaning stalls, and I was walking horses, and I was brushing horses, and I was getting horses ready for races, and I was a pretty good hand. And then we would have jockeys come down the shed row who couldn't give away enough cocaine. And then I'd have owners show up and hand out fifths of Crown Royal because their horse had won. And it was one party after party after party, and I lived in the tack shed. The guy I was working for took the interest in me and started training me. And before it was over with, I was able to go take tests and get my license, assistant trainer's license. And he started sending me and the jockey and the horse and the owner to run different futurities. Through some of my training, I also got to train on how to drug the horses. And I found out through all of that that they do drug tests on those horses. But I also found out they take the winning horse and take a blood sample and a urine sample, the second place horse and take a urine sample, and then pick a horse out of the field at random and take a urine sample. I also found out that the test barn only tests for one certain drug each day. So if you know what they're testing for, or if you have some ends with some of the vets, you never got caught. So once I learned what to use on the horses and how much to give them by how much they weighed, I kind of figured out how much they didn't need by how much I weighed. I did that for a number of years. I traveled around the country to different tracks with different horses, had some run in the All-American Futurity, had some run in Sunland Park, started taking them to Salisal, Oklahoma, and my dad showed up again. And we decided it would probably be good for us to move to Florida. So I got my paycheck and he got his, and we headed to Florida. It took us about a month and a half to get there. And when we got there, we didn't have any money. And we didn't have any jobs. And we started looking and we started doing. And before I knew it, I was living in Key West, Florida, out in the woods. In a box. I became real good at dumpster diving. See, I know what McDonald's does with their old hamburgers. I know what the barbecue place does with its old barbecue. And I know how to steal stuff at night to get something to drink or something to use. And that's how I lived for the next 6 months. At the end of that 6 months, I couldn't do any more. And I heard they were building a new racetrack in Denver. I knew I could get a job there. So we headed to Denver. And we got to Denver, and he had a friend that owned a wheat farm, and he let us live in a camper in his barn. And we got out to the racetrack, and it wasn't finished being built. There wasn't any horses there. I couldn't get a job. But my dad got a job at the track as chief of security. So he hired me as a security officer. So we took the night shift. And we would go drink all day and show up out there at night. And one of us would sit up in the guard shack, another would get in the truck and go patrol the barns and the grounds. And this went along pretty good. It worked out pretty nice for a while. One night we went out drinking and we got to work and it was cold. He told me to go get in that truck, go to them barns. I said, no, tonight's my night to stay up here in this warm shack. It's your night to get in that truck, go to them barns. And he told me no. And he told me he was the boss and all the good stuff. And I took my little badge off and I threw it on his desk and told him what he could do with that badge and told him didn't need him or that badge or that job. And he backhanded me and I fell back into the chair. And I got up and he said, give me your track license. I said, you can't take that, only the stewards can. And I walked out. And he followed me out. And he hit me again. And for the first time in my life, I wasn't afraid of my dad. And I started hitting him. And he went to the ground. And when he went to the ground, I started kicking him. Because he told me all my life, if I ever tried him, I better make sure what I was doing because I was going to the hospital. And I kicked him, and I kicked him, and I kicked him until he was laying there in a puddle of blood crying, asking me when I was going to go and kick him. And I got scared, and I ran and hid in the bushes. Somebody found me. The next thing I know, the ambulance was there, and I watched him put the mask on his face and put the IVs up to him and put him on a stretcher and take him away. And I got home the next morning to our camper, and he was laying in the camper. And he was swelled up and stitched up and black and blue. And I said, how you doing? And I felt about that big. He said, I feel like some damn punk kid done kicked me in the teeth. And I thought, you're in no shape to be talking to me like that. So I started on my career of what I'd been taught all my life, and I packed my bags and started my geographical tours. And I got on a plane, and I flew to Dallas, and I moved in with an aunt that I'd lived with when I was younger. And I worked, and I partied what I could, and I drank, and I went to the bars, and I chased the women, and I played pool. One day, my aunt introduced me to the man she was dating. I was working two jobs. He said, you like your job? I said, yeah, I like my job. I was driving a forklift, and I was working at Just Justin Boots. He said, well, would you quit it and come to work for me? I said, well, what would you have me do? He said, well, if you come to work for me, I'll pay your apartment rent. I'll pay all your utilities. I'll buy your food. I'll give you a new car to drive. I'll give you a gas card. I'll pay the insurance, and I'll give you $200 cash a week. Sound like a good deal to me. I said, so what do you want me to do? He said, I need a driver. I said, okay, a driver for what? He said, my driver quit and I need someone to drive me around in my limo to the different business meetings I have. I went to work for him. And that's all I did. I drove him around in his limousine to his different business meetings. And he paid for everything and handed me cash, and I got to take off. He started letting me use the limo on the weekends, and one night that he didn't have it, me and my buddies, we would get in it, and we would always go be somebody else. You know? We're just in town for the weekend on this big job, and we would take turns driving, and another one in the back. And that went on pretty well. One weekend, he asked me if I would take him to Paris, Texas to see his mom, and I told him I would. So we went to Paris, Texas in his limousine and spent the weekend, and I met his family and met people there. And one of the people I met was my future ex-wife. So we started this long-distance relationship, you know, Emma was talking about. And I don't know what she was building in her mind, Emma, but I know what I was planting. So I would go see her on the weekends, and one weekend I would show up in a new IROC, and one weekend I'd show up in the limo, and one weekend I'd show up in a DeLorean, and one weekend I'd show up in a new pickup truck, and one weekend I'd fly her up. She'd never flown before, so it was a small plane. So when they landed in Dallas, the pilot and the co-pilot carried her luggage for her through the airport, followed her out to the front. I was waiting for her in the limousine. Picked her up, took her to the hotel room, already had a dozen roses in the room, and I was the man. He ended up buying a ranch and wanted me to run it for him. So I went down there to run it for him, and next thing I knew, he wasn't dating my aunt anymore. And he went his way, and she went her way, and once again, I was sitting in Paris, Texas with no job and no place to live and no money. And my future ex-wife let me move in with her. So I moved in with her. It wasn't long after that we were married. I got a job making donuts at midnight. I would go in at midnight. I'd get off at 8 in the morning. Time to make the donuts. So I would go in to the donut shop after I've had a few, get everything going. While the dough's mixing, I would step out on the back and smoke one of those funny cigarettes, win all the prizes on the radio because I was the only one up all night. I would get off at 8 in the morning and go fishing. And on went my married life, and I thought, I have now arrived. So I went out in the front yard and actually built a little white picket fence around the front yard. Here we are. A typical day in my marriage was I would get off work, and Paris was dry. But 6 miles either side of town was a liquor store, and they called it a town. So you could go this way 6 miles to Sun Valley or this way 6 miles to Toco. Now, Toco was 10 cents cheaper than Sun Valley. So depending on what was going on, depending on which way I would go. And I would get off and I would go out and I would pick up a 12-pack and I would pull into town and I'd go down that street that no white boy is supposed to be on that street, so they knew what I wanted when I got there. And I would get a quarter bag and I would go home and I would watch TV and drink beer and smoke pot. And that's what I did on a daily basis. And that was my marriage. Somewhere along that line, I ended up getting a job for a hospital as a maintenance mechanic. And I started working at this hospital. About 2 years into my marriage, my wife was pregnant. And so here we go. And I started going to those classes where they're supposed to teach you how to breathe and stuff, right? That was crazy. But I went. I'm the responsible good husband. I have a job. I'm home every night. I'm going to the classes. I'm going to be a dad. Came time to have that baby. And my wife never would dilate. So after a few hours of that, they said, we're going to have to go in and take her into surgery and do a C-section. And they had told me in those classes if that happened, I wouldn't be able to be in there. So I started to take my gown off, and the anesthesiologist said, Bill, come on. I said, I can't go in there. They told me. He said, you work here. You can come in. So I went in there, and they set me on a stool in front of, but by her head, and they put this sheet up in front of her, and they put this thing in her back, and they put this IV in her arm, and he put this shot in her arm, and her eyes rolled back in her head. And he grabbed me by the shoulder and he said, it's going to be okay. And he put some oxygen on her face and I turned and the doctor had already had her stomach cut open. And it looked like he took his hand and stuck it in there all the way to his elbow and was doing this. And a little bit, this little head came out. And I said, look at that hair. That was Mom's number one request, was that hair. He said, well, what's the rest of it? Because the part was still in Mom. And I said, well, I hope there's a little thing down there. He pulled that baby out and he said, well, almost. And he cut that umbilical cord and handed her to me. And me and the doctor went in and laid her on that table and started wiping her off. And he put this hose in front of her face and she just turned pink like a thermometer all the way down to her toes. And I picked that little baby up and I walked in into that big picture window and all those people were out there and they were saying, is it a boy? Is it a girl? And all I could do was giggle and bawl. And giggle and bawl. And I sat down in that nursery and I started rocking that little baby girl and I started talking to her. And it was the happiest day of my life. And the nurses came in and said, you know, Bill, we really do need to measure her and weigh her. So I handed that baby girl to her, and they took her away, and I celebrated. And I went out and tied one on. Look what I've done. Went and picked her up, her mama up, took them home. Once again, we had arrived. Things rolled along for about 2 years, and I was working at that hospital, and we were doing okay. And I was still drinking, and I was still doing whatever. And one of my jobs, I changed shifts at the hospital, and I worked 3 to 11. And we had the only incinerator in town. So once a week, all the old folks' homes and pharmacies would show up with a 30-gallon trash bag full of drugs. And they would hand them to me and say, we need these burned. And I'd say, okay. And they would drive off. And I would go dump that bag in the shop floor. And I knew what some things in there were, but some things I didn't know what was. So I would go up to the emergency room and steal the PDR. You know what that is, right? Physician death reference. You probably have one on your bookshelf right next to your big book. I didn't know how to read a PDR. So I couldn't find a lot of the stuff. But if they had a little tag on them that said, maybe have it for me, or do not use with alcohol, or may cause drowsiness, you keep that. So then I started doing some trading. And then a guy I was working with at the hospital, one day after work, we went over to a friend's and we were sitting in the living room and we were drinking. And the next thing I know, I was the only one in the living room. And nobody else was there. So I got to looking for him and I found him. And they were all gathered up in the bathroom. And they were taking this brown stuff and putting it in this spoon and putting it in this needle, putting it in their arm. And it scared me. And I went back to the living room. Pretty soon they were all out there and they were a lot further along than I was. And so I was killing beers trying to catch up. And I finally said, let me try a little bit of that. And so for the next 5 years, I ran around drinking, eating pills, sticking needles in my arm. And in 1991, I decided what was wrong with my life was her. So I went home and told her one night what all her problems were and why we couldn't make it together. And I had the list. I'm tired of the dirty dishes. I'm tired of that kid crying. I'm tired of that laundry. I'm tired of no sex on demand. I'm tired of... And she sat there crying and said, we can work this out. And I said, yeah, but not together. We should get separate apartments. And we'll get together a few times a week and go out for dinner, and we'll work this out. She didn't think it was a good idea, but I did. So the next day, I left. And I went by the bank, and I took all the money. And the day after that, I moved in with another woman. And then we had to go to court for visitation. And I got to court for visitation, and she tried to tell the judge I was an alcoholic and that I was a drug addict. And I told the judge the reason she's saying that is because she's the one on drugs. So he told me, then you won't mind doing random UAs for visitation, will you? Not at all, sir. I walked out of that courtroom thinking, I cannot do that. What am I going to do? She has done it to me one more time. So I'll show her. And I walked across the hall and I went into the courtroom there. And I filed a motion to relinquish my parental rights, saying my daughter was not my daughter. And just a few years before this was the happiest day of my life when she was born. So I went on with my new life. And I didn't speak to her or my daughter for the next 6 months. One morning I got up and I went to the bathroom. And I looked at myself in the full-length mirror as I walked into the bathroom in this other woman's house. And to this day, I don't know what I saw in that mirror, but it scared me to death. The girl I was working with was also a nurse at the hospital, and she went to work, and I called my buddy, and he came over, and we packed everything I had and threw it in the back of the pickup, just like Dad taught me. And I had him go in and get all those prescription bottles, see, because this nurse that I was with, her brother was a doctor who was an addict, and he would call me in scripts if I sent him a refill. So I told him, get everything you want out of there, so I don't want nothing in this house with my name on it. And I started trying to find my wife at that time. And through a lot of begging and crying and pleading, I finally found where she was. And I told her, I said, I don't know what's going on, but I know I've messed up, and I need some help, and I don't know where to get it. She said, if you can be at my new apartment by 4:30 today, I can get you some help. I didn't make it there at 4:30. But when I got there, my daughter was standing there, and her friend. And I got out, and I went in that apartment, and I sat down on that couch, and I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know what to do. I didn't belong. My daughter was 3 years old. She came and crawled up on my lap, put her arms around my neck, gave me a kiss, and she said, I'm sorry, Daddy. She was ready at 3 years old to take responsibility for everything that I had done. So the next day, they took me up to a hospital to see about getting me some treatment. I was pretty shaky by that day. That doctor told me, yeah, you need some treatment. And all we need is $10,000 up front. And I thought, if I had $10,000, I wouldn't need your damn treatment. I got to the place where I was drinking all I could every day. I was eating 20 to 40 volumes of Vicodins on a daily basis and slamming heroin 4 or 5 times a day. I got down to 137 pounds, and they checked me into ICU. I spent 12 days in ICU, shaking, puking, cramping, hooked up to heart monitors, IVs, all kinds of stuff. And I remember the day they checked me in, I heard that doctor tell my wife outside the door, if we get him through the first 72 hours without his heart exploding, he may live. The next 12 days, I talked to people that weren't there. I had fish swim around my room. I shook. I shaked. And on the 13th day, they put me in a car, and they took me and checked me into a treatment center called Valley Hope. And I didn't want to be there. And I told her, I don't want to be there. I promise. I'll never do it again. Have you heard that? Yeah, she had too. She said, I'm not taking you home. So you know how we are. We have varied traits. That's what it says in the book. So I stepped on the other side of that fence. And I told her, let me tell you something. I don't know what you did on your 29th birthday, but I'm going to be in a treatment center, and if you don't take me home, you ain't going to live it down the rest of your life. She said, I'm not taking you home. So once again, I had to step on the other side of the fence. I don't care about the money we got. Just let me hide in the car, in the trunk even. She said, I'm not taking you home. I was mad. I didn't want to be there. I was green. I was sick. The snow was blowing sideways, and I was in Cushing, Oklahoma. There's nothing in Cushing, Oklahoma. Okay, there's sage grass, rocks, and oil barrels. So they sent me down to this thing called Patient House and her. And I went down and I sat in that room. And that night, three of the people that were in that center got up and took 12 minutes apiece and told their story of how they got up there. And I sat there and listened to them. And for the first time in my life, I went alone. For the first time in my life, I heard people hurting people like I hurt people. I heard people feeling and thinking the way I felt and thought. And I heard people drinking the way I drank. And when that session was over, I turned to my wife and I said, why don't you go home? Maybe I do need to be here. And she went home, and I started my 30 days of treatment. I finished my 30 days of treatment. I went home, started going to Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what they told me to do. And I had a man in that treatment center that gave me a hug the first day I met with him that I still remember to this day. And still to this day, he is a giant in my mind. So I went home and I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me I need to find some kind of aftercare, and I found a group that I could go to, and I started doing that. He told me I needed to make 90 meetings in 90 days, and I signed his little paper saying, yep, Bruce, that's what I'll do. And I'm thinking in my mind, I can't do that. I've been in here. I've been gone 6 months. I got to get a job. I've got a little kid. I got a wife. I can't do that. But I was telling him, I'll do that. And I think a lot of us do that. And I've been around long enough that now that I get to see newcomers come in. And I get to know newcomers. And I know they don't have a job. And I know they don't have nothing to do all day long but be to a meeting at 8 o'clock. And they walk in late. And you say, hey man, where you been? I've been busy. I don't know what we do when we get sober, but we stay busy. So I'm going to meetings, and they told me to get a sponsor. They said, pick you up a sponsor. It's got something you want. All right. I went to my very first meeting that night when I got home. There were three people there. And the guy chairing the meeting had 37 years of sobriety. And yeah, I thought, I'm supposed to get somebody that's got stuff that I want. I want 37 years. So I went up to him after the meeting and asked him if he'd be my sponsor. I told him I just got out of treatment today, and it's my first meeting, you're going to be seeing me around, and I need a sponsor, and I'd like you to sponsor me. And he handed me a card, had his name on it, said retired and all this kind of stuff. He said, give me a call sometime, we'll talk about it. And he walked off. And I looked at his card, and I looked at him walking off, and I threw his card in the trash. And I started going to more meetings. And then I started listening to this one guy talk who had his stuff together. So after the meeting, I went up to him and I introduced myself to him and told him I'd been out of treatment about 2 weeks now and I need a sponsor and I'd like you to sponsor me. He said, I'd love to be your sponsor. What's your phone number? Here's mine. What step are you on? How many days you got sober? Why don't we meet Friday? This guy wants to be a sponsor. So he started sponsoring me. We went at his, for our first meeting with him, and he said, so what step you on? I said, I'm ready for step 9. He said, what? I said, I'm ready for step 9. He said, okay. And he made a pot of coffee, and we sat down in his living room, and he said, if you're ready for step 9, why don't you just go ahead and explain the first 8 steps to me and how a person works them, and I'll listen. I said, okay. And I went to explaining the steps. And when I got done, he set his coffee cup down, and he said, you're ready for step 9. So I told you I was. He said, all right. So let's meet next week, and we'll start working on step 9. I said, all right. So I showed up, had made step list with me. We sit down. I said, okay, here's all the people I'm making amends to, and here's the ones I'm not. He said, what? I said, here's the people I'm making amends to, and here's the ones I'm not. I've already read step 9, and it says right here, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, and if I make amends to these people, it's going to hurt somebody, so I'm not doing those. And that's when I got my first nickname in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, look, jackass. He said, you read that black part and leave that white part alone. He said, that step does not say that you don't make amends if it's going to hurt them or others. It says that you don't make direct amends, but you're making amends. How do you do that? And that's how I started working with my sponsor. I was going to my meetings, and the meeting at that time was on Main Street, right across from the courthouse steps. So I would go to the meeting, and I'd park 2 blocks down the street around the corner, and I'd walk up Main Street looking in the store windows. And when nobody was coming, I would duck in that door. I had about 90 days, and I was at a new meeting, and my sponsor came in and sat down, and he said, hey, good. I said, I'm doing good. He said, so let me ask you a question. I said, all right. He said, you still parking down there around the corner? How does he know this stuff? And I said, yeah, James, I am. He said, how come? I said, James, I don't want people to see me coming in here. I said, all right. He said, let me tell you something. He said, the people that know you, they're glad to see you coming in here. The people that don't know you, they could care less where you're going. And it wasn't long after that, I'm waiting on the meeting, standing on Main Street, on the sidewalk, drinking coffee, waving at people. You know? I found out when I started working those steps at step one, when it told me I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable, that it was a two-part step, and my life consisted of my thoughts, feelings, and actions, and that unmanageable meant out of control. And just because I took the alcohol and everything else out of my system, it didn't put my thoughts, feelings, and actions back in control. Like we heard earlier today, you take the alcohol away from a horse thief, you're left with a horse thief. And that's how I was. My wife came back. My daughter came back. We started down our road again. My wife started going to Al-Anon, and she went for a year. And at the end of that year, she decided that's all she needed, and I needed to work the rest of it. And my marriage started going apart again. She also came home at the end of that first year and told me she had quit her job. And on the way home, she borrowed $95,000 because she didn't want to ask me because she knew I was not supposed to make any major life-changing decisions my first year. Blew me away. She started her own business. And at the end of 30 days, she had paid back every penny of that $95,000. And at the end of 2 years, we owned the largest home health agency in the state of Texas. We had 187 employees and 80 company cars, and was bringing in $450,000 a week. And we started going apart. And I was about 4 years sober because my daughter was about seven. It was late at night. She was upstairs asleep. I was sitting on the couch watching a movie. My daughter was laying on the floor. And she raised up. She said, Daddy? I said, yeah, baby. She said, Daddy, do you remember when you left me and Mama? And I thought, oh, my God. I said, yeah, baby, I remember. And that's why Daddy went to that hospital. And that's why Daddy goes to all those meetings now. She said, Daddy, did you know when you were gone, me and my mama used to cry every night for you to come home? And I started crying. And my heart fell out on the floor. And I couldn't talk. And that little girl said, Daddy, you're never going to leave me again, are you? No, baby. Never. She got up off that floor, crawled up into my lap, put her arms around my neck, gave me a kiss, and started patting me on the back. She said, it's okay, Daddy, because I love you. A year later, my wife asked me for a divorce. And I just promised her I'd never leave her again. And she had a miscarriage. And I sat in that hospital with her laying on that bed crying and that seven-year-old little girl in my lap crying, telling me her baby sister had just died. And I had to be strong for them. And I didn't know what to do for me. And I would go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit there and cry. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know where else to turn. And the members of that meeting and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me, because I could no longer, once again, love myself. You got the divorce, and in any good divorce, you lose everything. Once again, I had my pickup and anything I could put in the back of it. And I got asked to go speak in Marshall, Texas at a meeting. And I went down there to speak, and I noticed this cute little Al-Anon. I watched about half the night. About half the night was over, she come walking right up to me. She said, "I bet you don't know who I am." And I was thinking that I'd like to. I said, "No, I don't." She said, "Well, give me a hug and I'll tell you." I stood up and gave her a hug and she said, "I'm Tammy." See, 10 years ago, I used to work in a donut shop for her daddy. And we started going out. Have coffee after the meeting. Started the date. And about a year and a half later, on December 1st, on her birthday, for her birthday present, I got on my knees and I opened her a box and I asked her to marry me. And she did. And she came as a package deal. She had a little girl that was 5. And a little boy that was about 8, and a little boy that was about 10. And I asked her one day, and you'll like this one, Emma. I asked her one day, I said, "You know, I need to know something. I need to know who's responsible for your happiness." And that hand went on that hip, and that Al-Anon salute came out. And she said, "Let me tell you something. You can't make me happy." She said, "I have to pick my own happiness, and then you can add to it." And I thought, this is a healthy woman. And my wife was supposed to come and speak this weekend, and that youngest daughter had a band concert come up today, and she went to the band concert with my daughter so I could be here. And there's some people in this room that see my wife and know my wife. And I need to let you know tonight, she's just as beautiful on the inside as she is on the out. And she works in Al-Anon programming, and she's been going to Al-Anon for over 18 years. I was sitting in my counselor's office when I was in treatment, and I was a kid in there asking him, "How do you be a counselor?" And he told me to go stay sober, and then he'd tell me how. And I stayed sober. And he told me how. And I started volunteering at a crisis center. See, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could care less about you or anybody unless you had something I wanted. And if you had something I wanted, I would emulate some interest in you until I got what I wanted. And then I'd cast you aside like somebody's used trash. And that's how I lived. And my first job, when I started trying to go on this other career, I went to a crisis center and I volunteered my time and my gas and my money to tell people in that place about Alcoholics Anonymous. The book talks about that spiritual awakening and talks about it has to be a total personality change. And if that's not a total personality change, I don't know what one is. That one nothing to do with nobody. And now all I wanted to do was give to everybody. And I got on and I went to school and I got on to go ahead and God found it okay to pay me what I was doing for free. My life today is different than any dream I'd ever imagined. When I was coming up on my 10-year anniversary in sobriety, I didn't know what else there would be. I had in my mind that I was fixing to have 10 years of sobriety and this looks as good as it's going to get. And where would I go from here? And this is all there is to it. And I went home. And the phone rang. And I answered it. And this voice on the other end of the phone said, "Is this Bill?" I said, "Yeah." "Who's this?" He said, "This is your little brother." I hadn't seen my mom Well, I'm a brother and sister, 36 years. I heard from them. And I thought, yeah, right. So he started telling me about my life. And he started telling me where I had lived and where I had worked and who I had been married to and who I was married to now and how many children I had. And he knew way too much. And he had hired a private investigator to find me. And I got to sit in a meeting in Elizabeth, Colorado and pick up a 10-year medallion with my little brother sitting next to me. He stepped off that plane, and I knew him when he stepped off the plane and had never seen him. And we had the same clothes on. He liked the same things I liked. And he was a good man. And I found out that for the last 12 years before that, he had lived 2 hours from me. And he sat in that meeting with me. And I had went to that meeting thinking, 10 years, it's all over. Once again, God showed me that if I would get out of the way, he can work miracles in my life. A month later, I was standing in DIA watching the airplane pull in and my mom step off of that airplane that I hadn't seen 36 years. And I'd went through my whole life wondering what it was like to have your mom give you a hug. I went through my whole life wondering what it was like to sit in your mama's lap. And that lady stepped off that plane, and I cried, and she cried. And I gave her that hug. And while we were hugging, the thought went through my head. This doesn't feel like any of the hug. There's nothing special about it. And I walked out of that airport carrying her bags with her talking to my wife, wondering what this was going to happen, what this was going to be like. See, when I married her, she came with that package deal. And I'd heard all the stories about stepdads, and I'll beat you like a stepchild. And I knew I had to have a relationship with those kids just like I did with her. And so we took something from Aladon, and we started having family meetings. We'd have a family meeting every Sunday night, 6 o'clock, and let those kids say anything they needed to say with me keeping my mouth shut. The oldest one, he was a real standoffish kid. He wasn't a touchy-feely, huggy, nothing like that. The littlest one, the girl, she would say, "I'm Nessa, I have nothing to say." All right. We were doing those family meetings, and it wasn't long that that oldest son went to go to bed one night. He went walking back, and he stopped me, leaned over, and gave me a hug. And he didn't hug his buddy. He said, "Good night." And I had that little girl say, "Where'd you come from?" I said, "I came. Okay." She said, "Oh, I was thinking God sent you." January the 17th of this year, I got to stand in the meeting in Elizabeth, Colorado, and hand a 17-year-old son a 1-year medallion. And I'm more proud today of his 15 months than I am any of my time. And I have a 14-year-old son now that's a heck of a baseball player. And I'm one of his heroes. And I have a little girl that gets sad when her daddy's away. And I have a 15-year-old little girl still in Texas who's wondering if her daddy ever loved her because I lost my parental rights in the divorce. And I know what's in my heart. And I know one day she'll grow up. And I know one day we're going to have a talk. Just like me and my mama did. And I let my mama know that I didn't understand why she didn't take me. And she let me know about the abuse. And it's all she could do was to grab two and get out of the house before he got back with me. And she was feared for her life of him coming back. And I let her know that inside of me was a little bit of boy who was still scared and frightened. I wasn't ready for her mama yet. And we better learn to just be friends first. So that's how we are today. We're learning how to be friends. And I have a brother that I got to stand in his wedding when he got married. And I got to see a sister that I hadn't seen in 36 years. And I get to work with newcomers on a daily basis. And I get to be one of them. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says, work this program one day at a time. And if I work this program one day at a time, every day I show up, I'm a newcomer. Because yesterday's gone and tomorrow's not here. My sponsor also taught me to read out of that 12 and 12 that all of the program doesn't come out of that big book. That there's some other books it comes out of. And I found out that on the first page of the foreword of the 12 and 12 in the third paragraph it says, A's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, when if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I don't work the steps on a daily basis. I do what that book just told me to do. I practice the principles of the steps on a daily basis. And today, I have a life that is happy and whole. And if it wasn't for people in this room and around this country, I'd have missed it all. So thanks for listening to me tonight. Thanks for being here. And if you're new in here, and you haven't figured out how to love yourself, stick around and let us love you until you can love yourself. And if you don't have a sponsor, get one. And if you don't know anything about those steps, start working on them. And if you don't know what the principles are, you can't practice them. In the place I work now, I challenge all those newcomers at least once a week. See, my wife works there too. She's the one that gives them their bed, and then I'm the one that gets to talk to them. And I tell them, you know my wife, she gave you a bed. You go ask her if I live this program. I'll bring my children up here. You ask any of them if I live this program. I will give you the name and number of anybody I sponsor, and you ask them if I live this program. Because if I don't, I'm out selling more Crocs of shit. And you bought enough Crocs in your life. See, I found out early on it ain't about drinking and drugging. It's about living and dying. And it's my life. And I do this because it's my life. I can't do it for you. You got to do it because it's your life. But I care if you do it or not. And before I close, let me tell you why I care. See, because I believe if I can do it in my family, and I can get some of you to do it in your family, maybe pretty soon I live in a neighborhood that everybody's doing it in their family. Maybe pretty soon I live in a whole community where families are changing. Maybe pretty soon I live in a country called the United States of America that can get back to being the country it's supposed to be. Maybe pretty soon I don't have to worry about my daughter getting killed in a drive-by. I don't have to worry about my 14-year-old son getting introduced to marijuana behind the gym, and I don't have to worry about my 17-year-old son coming home wearing his gang colors. Maybe pretty soon I can leave my bedroom window open at night, and it's not an invitation for someone to come into my home. Maybe. Maybe I'm full of it. Maybe I'm not. It's my life. It's my kid's life. It's my wife's life. If it wasn't for you, I could have missed it all. I want to thank the committee, Jeff and Steve and everybody for inviting me. I appreciate you listening. I've had a wonderful time this weekend. Met some wonderful people, and everybody has been so friendly, and Jeanette was right. I haven't laughed so much that my face hurt in a long time. Keep coming back. It works. And I got proof. Thank you.